Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me this week is Dr. Alyssa Golis, Director of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Let's start with how you got to this point. What made you decide? I mean, if you're a doctor, you could probably have done anything in the field, any medical field, but you chose plastic surgery. What drove you into that direction?
Well, I really liked surgery because I like doing things with my hands, and I like seeing immediate solutions to problems. So I did I did general surgery training first, and while I was doing general surgery, you get to rotate through all different kinds of surgery, and then I was drawn to plastic surgery in particular because you operate on patients of all ages. You operate not just on one body part, but really head to toe, and it takes a lot of spatial reasoning and creative problem solving because every problem and every patient is different. I just really enjoyed the variety of things that I saw during my plastic surgery rotations and training.
Do you find that most of the doctors that you work with or you've worked with in your career kind of went that way, in that it's kind of like when you go into college undecided, you go into medical school, and then you kind of follow the path wherever it takes you?
Yeah, and I think one of the good things about medical school is that you get to rotate through a lot of different specialties. So you get like a real flavor for what it's like to be in that specialty, because there's really no way for us to know. We might think we know what we want to do when we grow up, but there's really no way to know exactly until you're really in it.
Sure. And I guess on the opposite side of it, maybe you are interested, and maybe you were interested in plastic and reconstructive surgery. Then you went to medical school and you thought, oh, wait, this isn't for me. I'm going to go in a different direction.
Yeah, exactly.
Happens both ways. All right. Well, let's talk about what you do there at JFK. Some of the, you know, what would be some of the reasons, we'll get into breast reduction now and then skin removal after weight loss. What are some of the reasons for breast reduction? There are several, but what makes someone a candidate?
The real reason to do a breast reduction that's considered a medically necessary breast reduction that would be covered by your insurance is a patient having symptoms due to their breasts that don't get better with other treatments. Specifically, this can be back or shoulder pain or neck pain, where patients have done a course of physical therapy and it didn't help, or they've taken NSAIDs like Aleve or Naprosyn for several weeks and that didn't help. Other reasons can be that they're having rashes underneath their breasts, and they've tried like prescription dermatologic treatments like creams or ointments, and those things haven't helped. And those are the reasons that they're typically covered by insurance. There are a lot of other reasons that people want a breast reduction as well. Just they have breasts that are large. They can make people feel self-conscious. They have difficulty fitting into clothing or bathing suits. They have difficulty exercising. And it can be like a real detriment. Like it can really interfere with people's quality of life, their ability to do sort of normal activities, and their self-esteem.
And what's the most common reason? Is it because it's necessary, because of pain and other things that you mentioned?
Pain. I mean, it really, back and shoulder pain is so, so common. And, you know, breast reduction, it literally like takes a weight off people's shoulders a lot of times after
literally,
surgery.
Literally, yeah.
They wake up feeling better. I mean, the pain from surgery is less than the pain that they're dealing with because of their breast.
Now, what if someone decides to have breast reduction surgery for aesthetic reasons, and they just feel too big? But can it be reversed if they change their mind? If they have the surgery and then they wait a second, this wasn't a good idea. And how do you prevent that from happening as well? Like the thought. Like I'm sure you talk with your patients beforehand, right?
About everything. Yeah, that's the most important thing, is to talk to patients beforehand and be sure that they really have an idea of like what to expect after surgery, and just to be sure that you know exactly what their goals are and what their motivations are for seeking out surgery. But if they do regret it, which is honestly is very rare, I've never really seen a patient regret doing a breast reduction.
Okay.
It's not reversible per se.
Yeah,
get the breast larger, you'd have to like use an implant or use a technique that's called fat grafting. But it's not like a reversible surgery.
Right. I understand. So in that surgery, and also the extra skin that people have after weight loss, That's another type of surgery you do, correct?
Correct, yes. Yeah.
And do you actually remove skin? How does that work?
Yeah, you have to remove the skin. And it's something that people don't always hear about. Like when they're talking about weight loss surgery or these weight loss medications, they don't really learn about this when they're talking to their bariatric surgeon very often. But when people lose a lot of weight, the fat goes away, but all that extra skin that contains the fat doesn't shrink down. You can end up with a lot of loose skin, and people can find that distressing, even sometimes more so than being overweight. Mm-hmm. When you're a kid or a teenager and you lose a lot of weight, your skin is still really elastic and it shrinks down. But when you're an adult, it doesn't happen as well. And the older we get, the less well that this happens. People can be left with a lot of like loose skin on their arms, their mm-hmm. legs, their abdomen. And just like with the breast reduction, the skin can interfere with their ability to do things. Like it makes it difficult to exercise. People get a lot of rashes underneath their skin, mm-hmm. especially underneath the abdominal fold. And that's a really common reason for doing the surgery through insurance. But also people just don't like the way it looks. You know, they mm-hmm. go through all of this hard work to lose weight and to keep that weight off. And then they're sometimes left feeling that they look worse than they did before they lost the weight, which is really, which is really sad. So the surgery just can help with that.
And we're talking primarily the body from the neck down?
Even the face. I mean, I don't do those surgeries for a face, but sometimes people, when they lose a lot of weight, they lose it in their face as well, and they can end up needing something like a facelift to mm-hmm. sort of recreate the natural facial contours. But one thing I do want to stress for these surgeries is that in life, nothing is free, and these things are always a trade. And in this particular case, it's a trade of skin for scars. So people, in order to remove the skin, you have to make cuts, and those leave you with pretty lengthy scars.
Okay.
So that is the trade-off for it.
That was one of my questions. Any indications or evidence of surgery after the healing time? And you're saying there definitely is.
Definitely. For all of these surgeries, all of it is a trade.
In every case.
Yeah, nothing is free.
Yeah. When you say free, you don't mean finance. Well, obviously, there's a cost. But you're talking about you're trading one thing for another.
You're trading one thing for another, exactly.
Is there ever a case where the scarring is not seen because of the type of... where the location of the skin removal is?
Well, we try to keep it hidden as much as possible. So, sure. Like if you remove abdominal skin, we try to keep it so that the scar is hidden in your underwear or in your bathing suit bottom. And that's pretty successful. But in terms of, skin from the thighs or the arms, you'd have a scar that goes from like the inside of your elbow up to your armpit and then down onto your chest wall. So, like, if you're wearing sort of long sleeves, you can't see it. But if you're wearing a tank top and mm-hmm. you raise your arms, it's going to be seen.
But
I was saying, the way that people scar, like the way that the scar looks, in a lot of ways is genetic. Like there are some things that that plastic surgeons can do to make the scars look better, but for the most part, it's contained in like your DNA. Mm-hmm. So if you're someone who makes like dark, thick scars. You can expect that those scars from the surgery are going to look dark and thick as well. If you make fine, thin scars, then that's what you should expect after these surgeries too. And it's difficult. You have to be prepared that the scar, it's going to be there and it's going to be visible.
Is this a major concern among people? Because it sounds to me it's like a minor concern. If I'm getting what I'm trading, it's totally worth the trade for me. But do you find that some people are overly concerned about that and sometimes don't even have the surgery because they'd rather have the extra skin than the scar?
Rarely. I think people are usually just so bothered by the extra skin that they're right. willing to accept the scars.
Yeah,
but that's another example where like counseling before surgery is just really, really important because patients have to know to expect this. And if they aren't expecting it and they wake up with these horrible scars, then it can be really upsetting. But most of the time, people are willing to make that trade.
Talking with Dr. Alyssa Golis, Director of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at JFK University Medical Center. Well, let's talk about the pre-surgery conversation that you have. Let's say I'm somebody, I've lost 100 pounds, I have a lot of extra skin all over my body, my neck. I know there's a term for that. You know, your neck is hanging down, things like that. And I come in, I'm like, I want to get this taken care of. What's the process from that point forward? I mean, do they call you directly or do they go to, is there something they would talk to their primary first and then be referred to you or something like that?
It really depends on your insurance plan and how, like what sort of hoops you need to jump through to get referrals. Most of the patients that I see are referred by their bariatric surgeon, by their weight loss surgeon. Mm-hmm. But once in a while, people are self-referred. They find my name on the internet and call and make an appointment. But everyone's insurance company is a little bit different in terms of what they need to see a plastic surgeon.
Okay, so I get to your office and you meet with me first. How does that go? Like, hi, doctor, I want this skin to be removed. And then what do you
say? So we would sit down and talk about your medical history, any medical problems you have, any surgeries you've had in the past, what medications you take, things like that. Mm-hmm. I would need to know how much weight that you lost. And also, importantly, you need to know that you've kept it off for a while because it's, you know, you want to be at your goal weight mm-hmm. and stable at that goal weight for a while before doing surgery. It would be a shame to do the surgery after you've lost 100 pounds and then you lose another 50 pounds. And then you lose another 50 pounds after surgery.
Oh, I see.
And then
okay.
you have extra skin again. So we want to be sure that you've reached your goal weight, that it's a healthy goal weight for you, and that you're stable at that weight for, you know, usually 3 to 6 months at least before doing the surgery.
When you started on that thought, I was thinking in the opposite direction. You want to make sure that if I lose a significant amount of weight and then the surgery is done, what happens if I regain that weight after the surgery? Is there a danger there?
It's like a waste of a surgery in a sense. But, and you stretch out your skin again as
yeah.
you gain that weight. And then it sort of undoes the effects of the surgery.
Right, but is this, because I have less skin, is there any type of danger there? Because
no
I have
danger.
Less skin to
no,
stretch.
No
so I have skin that was already stretched. You got rid of the skin that was stretched the most, and then I'm stretching that old skin again. Is that, am I overthinking this?
I think the body accommodates it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, you can stretch your skin out again. Yeah. I mean, if you think about like women who have been pregnant and they are pregnant, they have a baby, their skin sort of retracts a bit, then they get pregnant again. The skin accommodates it over time because it happens slowly. So unfortunately, you can stretch your skin out more.
But pregnant women don't have skin removed after pregnancy. That's the thought that was going through my head.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Pregnant women don't have skin removed after pregnancy and then get pregnant again.
That's correct. Right. But it does contract them down some. It does
okay.
like shrink down
All right.
some.
It's not a concern. I mean, it's not a concern, correct? Obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So when we're going through either of these surgeries, is it what's the pain factor there?
It can be uncomfortable. I mean, we're not doing anything with the muscle or the bone, so that makes it, you know, less painful compared to some other surgeries. But the cuts are big, like they're long incisions, and mm-hmm. They can be uncomfortable, especially when we're doing surgery for this extra skin in the thighs. The incision goes up from the inside of your knee up the inside of your thigh into your groin, and that can be difficult for things like walking and mm-hmm. going to the bathroom. It's tough. It's worth it, but it can be uncomfortable, and patients usually do require pain medicine after surgery, at least for a couple of days.
A couple of days for the pain medication, but what's the total healing time?
Total healing time, like I usually let patients go back to normal activities like exercise, weightlifting, swimming after about a month.
Okay.
But the scars, are usually not fully mature until around 3 to 6 months afterwards. And once in a rare while, patients can have complications, like they can have things like infections or wound healing problems, and that can slow the process down. But in most cases, usually by about a month, you can go back to normal activities.
Is there some sort of ointment that they're applying for those months or any other type of medication other than the pain medication?
Yeah, there's lots of things on the market that patients use to improve the appearance of their scars, because there's lots and lots of companies that want to take your money. But there's very little data for those kinds of things. Like, they're not really evidence-based. And the only thing that really has strong evidence behind it is silicone tape or silicone sheeting to improve the appearance of scars.
Okay.
So I have patients start using silicone tape on their incisions about 1 month after surgery, as long as everything's healing well. But prior to that, they'll have like the stitches under their skin, which are absorbable, and they'll also have some tapes that we'll place on the incisions. They're called Steri-Strips or Prinio, things like that, that help from the outside just to help support the incision.
So vitamin E, is that a myth for scars?
I think it's a myth. I mean,
okay.
You know, patients, everyone's different. And if you find something that you think works for you, there's certainly no harm in using something like vitamin E.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the moisturizing properties of all those products are good. But there's no real great data for it.
Dr. Alyssa Golis is the Director of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at JFK University Medical Center. Let's pivot here, and we want to talk about breast cancer reconstructive techniques. There's different types of breast cancer reconstruction techniques that you use. Could you explain the difference, or what they are, and we'll get into the differences?
Sure. So, I mean, the first consideration is the kind of surgery that the patient has to remove their cancer. So there's different ways it's done. And in one case, only the portion of the breast that has the cancer is removed. That can be called a lumpectomy or a partial mastectomy. And the other case, the entire breast is removed, which is called a mastectomy. So the reconstructive techniques are, you know, there's different ones for different kinds of cancer removal.
Mm-hmm.
So if a patient is just having a lumpectomy, they either, if the lumpectomy is small, they may not need any reconstruction at all. But if the lumpectomy is a little bit larger, sometimes it can be deforming to the breast. In that situation, there's things that we can do to camouflage that defect. We call those oncoplastic techniques. And we do a little bit of rearranging of the breast tissue to camouflage that defect.
Okay.
In other situations, we can do sort of a combination procedure. We call it like a breast reduction, where we do a breast reduction and plan it so that the part that's being removed contains the cancer. Or we call that an oncoplastic reduction. And we would do what we call a symmetrizing reduction on the other side to make the two sides match.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a patient who otherwise have been thinking about getting breast reductions can now have their breast reduction done at the same time that their cancer is removed, which can be like a really great way of making a difficult situation into something good. And patients really like that.
Right. So when you reshape the breast, you're removing the part of the breast that had the lump for the lumpectomy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But that is done prior. Is this all in one surgery?
All in one surgery.
Oh, okay.
It takes planning. So I work together with the breast surgeon. The breast surgeon is the one who removes the cancer. And we work together, and usually at the same time. So it's done, you know, with minimal addition to the anesthesia time. They have both the surgeries at the same time.
Okay. You work with gender-affirming surgery as well. Now, this is for transgender and gender non-binary patients, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How long has this been offered at JFK, and how long have you been performing this?
Well, I just started at JFK in June of this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I did a fair amount of at my previous position. I was at NYU for about 5.5 years before coming here.
Okay.
And did a fair amount of it there, and I'm excited to bring it to JFK and to start the program here.
Sure. It's becoming more and more popular, I would imagine, every day.
I think we're having more and more awareness of it. I think it's something mm-hmm. that people weren't really comfortable talking about before. And I think that although the need has always been there, I think that there haven't been that many surgeons or other medical providers who've, you know, had experience in treating patients with gender dysphoria.
So are you saying that it's becoming more commonplace because those who wanted it were afraid to ask for it?
And I think that the techniques, like it wasn't covered by insurance. The techniques to do the surgeries weren't really common, or people weren't comfortable with them. So I think for a lot of reasons, it's becoming more and more not routine, but I'd say, standards of care are more known and more accepted right now than they were, say, 20 years ago.
More accepted. It would be that. Yes. Okay. So when someone comes to you, do they, again, it's just kind of the same question as before, do they come to you directly and say, this is what I want to do, or how does it lead up to the surgery itself?
Typically, when patients come to me, they've already been going through the process for a while. It's unusual for someone to come right off the street and say, I want to have my breasts removed, for example. And in that case, I would have to refer them out because they have to have been working with a mental health care provider for a while to discuss like their symptoms of gender dysphoria and their goals of treatment. Mm-hmm. They have to, be living in their gender identity for several months to years before going through surgery. They have to have a letter of support from their mental health care provider saying that this has been an ongoing thing. So in that case, they've already done a lot of work before they get to me. So I often get referrals through LGBTQ care centers, in the community that they have lists of providers who perform these types of surgeries. But also I get a lot of patients who are referred through their peer groups. People see or know patients that have had these surgeries and they seek out surgeons whose results that they like, which is a really great way of getting referrals.
So as with any other elective surgeries, is it an elective? I mean, is it always cosmetic? Would that be the word?
No, these are medically necessary.
Medically necessary. Okay.
Covered by insurance. Yeah.
It's medically necessary. It endangers their life.
It's difficult to categorize because it's for insurance reasons it's coded as a medical diagnosis.
Okay.
But it is it's not like pathologic. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the person, but feeling like an incongruence with the gender you were assigned at birth and the way that you feel can be really distressing. It causes people symptoms of it can cause people symptoms of depression and mm-hmm. anxiety and even suicidality. So it really can be a danger to people's lives. But it also really just affects their quality of life. And I think that's probably a better way to describe it.
Okay.
It really takes away from their quality of life when their gender identity doesn't align with the gender, with the sex that they're assigned at birth.
Right. That makes perfect sense. But I would imagine other people, and I'm glad we're talking about this, look at it as an elective surgery. Do you get that a lot?
I mean, it's an elective surgery in the same way that a breast reduction is elective surgery. It's not an emergency. Like, it doesn't
have
to be done right away, but it's for, a medically necessary condition to improve patients' lives.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So elective is the wrong word.
Yeah, I would say medically necessary.
Okay, so it's medically necessary. Now, is there ever a time where a patient comes in and then you have the original consult, like we talked about earlier with the other surgeries, and you do not recommend it? You find that a patient
go ahead with the surgery?
Cannot or should not go ahead with the surgery. Is that
I mean, I think if people have other medical problems that aren't well controlled, like say they have diabetes and their blood sugar is very mm-hmm. high, they have to get that under control. I won't operate on people if they're smoking because nicotine, tobacco is really, really bad for healing and it increases your chance of having a wound healing problem. So I will ask people to quit smoking before surgery because that's a really controllable risk factor. If patients, I feel like if they have very specific goals that I don't think that I can meet, then I will turn them away because it's really important for patients to have expectations that I can achieve. Like if I can't meet their goals, then they're mm-hmm. going to be disappointed. Or if they haven't, if this is not something they've been thinking about for a long time, if this is a new decision for them, it's something that is really worth going back and talking to your mental health care provider about and being really, really sure that this is the direction that you want to go in before proceeding.
Yeah, I would imagine that after surgery, obviously with the patients that you have performed the gender affirming surgery on, it must be life changing in such a positive way. Do you see that?
Yeah,
regularly.
I mean, I think that's why I love doing these kinds of surgeries, just because there's so many happy tears, and it's such a joy to see people feel like themselves and finally feel like themselves and be happy and confident and do the things they want to do. It makes me just feel so good, and I just love it, honestly, because it just makes people so happy.
I can feel it. Like, I'm getting a little emotional in thinking about it. I can imagine, you know, they must be like, oh my gosh, finally, this is where I've always needed to be, and now I'm here. They must fall to tears in many cases.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a great feeling.
Amazing.
It's a great feeling. It's, you know, maybe it's a selfish thing, but I just love that feeling, and I like being able to do that for people and make them feel that way. It's really powerful. And it goes back to, you know, you asked like why I wanted to be a plastic surgeon, and it's like an immediate change for people. Like, you take the dressings off and they look down and they're happy. And it's actually studied there, you know, there really is a very, very low incidence of regret for patients undergoing what we call top surgery, or chest masculinization surgery. It's exceedingly low, and it is a wonderful thing for the people who are the right candidates for it.
Well, you're doing wonderful things, and we're glad we have you now in Central Jersey. Dr. Alyssa Golis, Director of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at JFK University Medical Center. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more info, you can go to jfkmc.org. And for a podcast of this show, go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health. It's brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. Until next week.